Welcome to the Shortlist Podcast. Our guest today is Michael Matherly, COO and co-founder of Compliance Solutions. Michael has over 20 years in procurement services related to strategic sourcing and vendor and talent management. Over the last decade, Michael has delivered IC compliance and procurement outsourcing services to mid and large size organizations. On today's show, we discuss different freelancer models, what and who can trigger a misclassification claim, and tips to help you stay compliant as your freelancer workforce grows. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast for expert takes and unique insight from the world of contingent work. Let's get to it. Michael, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tyler. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Early on in your process, what you'll do is you'll try to define the type of freelancer model. If you could explain a little bit about the different working models and what makes them different in terms of the length of engagement or the structure of the work itself.
Yeah, it's there are a lot of different criteria, a lot of different elements to look at, but generally we try to make a distinction between, is it a traditional compliance model, or is it more of a gig platform or on-demand type of model for that requires a slightly different solution. Traditional is really like it sounds. It's what we've known in our industry for years. The gig platform, the on-demand, as you can imagine, is with the the growth and the popularity and the just the new innovation in our space around creating platforms for marketplaces for buyers and sellers of microservices or project-based services to come together. And that creates a unique compliance issue that has to be dealt with. And I don't think our industry as a whole has really figured it out completely. And we've certainly got the regulators weighing in and sort of trying to drive the discussion or the conversation. But yeah, that's how we segment it at the top is between traditional and gig.
And it sounds like this distinction could be difficult to make. Would you recommend that companies try to tackle this themselves?
I think it all, you have to measure your risk, and that includes a lot of factors. What size company are you? Are you publicly traded? Do you, how many freelancers or independents do you engage on a regular basis? What kind of work are you having them do? All of that sort of weighs into that kind of conversation or to that decision, Tyler. What we recommend is that you have a qualified group do an IC compliance assessment so that you can have an outside third party, someone who specializes in classification screening and providing compliance services, do that kind of assessment and give you that feedback. There are a lot of options on managing your IC compliance risk internally and with third-party providers. And it really just depends on each company's unique situation.
And on these components of risk, where do they come from? And I want to speak specifically on the traditional freelance model, just because that's sort of more familiar, I think, to most companies.
Yeah. Well, the origins of risk are... the easy answer is to say from anywhere. One of the things that we see in defending the propriety of IC classifications is that the facts matter, right? It, just like any lawsuit or court case or anything that's pending in front of it, an agency, what the specific facts matter. And while that makes sense, it also creates a bit of a challenge for companies and for service providers like ourselves, because we have to anticipate what those potential facts are that might go into an inquiry or to a claim against the propriety of an IC classification. So for instance, you might set up a contract that says this person, Tyler, is a independent contractor. But if you engage Tyler and then treat him like an employee during the engagement, then the contract really doesn't matter. What really matters is the facts that the client invited you to staff meetings, you went to the company Christmas party, you did all sorts of things like an employee would do at their employer. So that's kind of my bigger scope caution is don't think that there is one aspect that you can zero in on and actually solve all your problems. But to answer your question more scientifically, if you will, we have done studies on where do IC misclassification inquiries or claims come from. Meaning if an agency, and again, just to be clear for the audience, you know, it could be the IRS, it could be the Department of Labor, it could be any one of the different states, it could be the wage and hours division, it could be the unemployment division, it could be the workers' compensation commission. Those are all areas that look at and care about the classification of workers. So that's one aspect. They, you know, those regulatory bodies are nothing to overlook. I mean, there's a lot of them and there's a lot of moving parts. But surprisingly, we found in our study that they were the number three trigger of groups that drive IC misclassification claims or inquiries. The number one group that actually was responsible for it were the contractors themselves, which again is why we focus a lot on managing the contractor in every contractor that comes into our programs, whether it's, you know, through our collaboration with Shortlist or when we go direct to clients. They have to participate in some level of IC compliance and best practices training. I'll give you an example why. When we say that the biggest driver of misclassification claims is the contractor, we looked at and said, well, you know, what are they doing that is causing? That's the obvious question.
Yeah.
So, what are they doing? Well, some of it, a lot of it, I mean, we think most of it is inadvertent, meaning they just didn't understand, they made a mistake. Some of it is intentional, but I'll get to that in just a minute. But the contractor-based inquiries, triggered inquiries or claims, are the top four were they made a mistake on their taxes, meaning they reported the wrong number from their 1099. When a company or a third-party intermediary like Compliance Solutions engages a contractor, we issue a form 1099 miscellaneous to each contractor who's worked over $600 in a calendar year. We put the exact amount of pay on that form. The contractor's job, because they are technically their own small business, they're self-employed, they have to carry that 1099 number over exactly to their 1065 partnership form or to their Schedule C on their income taxes. Anytime there's a discrepancy, the IRS has a, as you can imagine, they will receive an alert. Hey, this is the wrong number. If it's material, if it's going the wrong way, then, you know, that's going to drive or trigger an inquiry. The other things that we found were contractors were submitting or trying to claim unemployment insurance. But the reality is they are their own employers, they're self-employed. So the end client they work for really isn't their employer. But oftentimes the contractors don't understand this. And, you know, to a certain extent, we understand this and there's some sympathy there because, you know, maybe they got terminated from the engagement early, or maybe it just ended and they just can't find new business. So what they do is they say, well, I got to file for unemployment. And they name the last company they quote unquote worked for, but if they worked for them as a 1099, then that wasn't their last employer. The last thing I'll mention is the same thing with workers' compensation. If they get injured, whether it's on the job or not, we find that drives a lot of misclassification inquiries because there's the tendency if they don't have insurance or if they do have insurance and they need to name a worker, because every time you go into a hospital or to a doctor's office with some kind of injury, they're asking you, did this happen at work? Well, you say yes. and then you sort of have to name somebody, and without thinking they've triggered an inquiry. So those are very trainable items to circle it back. And we can train the contractors to be aware of that. We can help them understand why a misclassification actually works against them. We can help them understand that it protects their business as a small business or as an independent contractor when they avoid being misclassified. Now, we want everybody to be properly classified, but once you're classified as a 1099, you know, you don't want to mess things up and inadvertently trigger an inquiry and maybe, you know, have a regulator come in and reclassify you. That's painful for everybody, and it especially including the contractor, because they have to redo their taxes. They can't take all those business deductions that they like to take. It really causes a challenge for everybody.
And that's so interesting to hear that something as simple as an accounting error could trigger one of these claims, or an unforeseen circumstance like a hospital visit. Yeah. I wouldn't have necessarily thought that. Now, why should a company care? You know, what does the penalty look like for a misclassification claim?
Wow, it's all over the map. But the two things that I can say, one is if it's an individual claim, then it can be as high as $80,000 for the average contractor. And generally what we're looking at there is when you have a reclassification, meaning for whatever reason, the IRS comes in and reclassifies that 1099 worker to a W-2 and says, no, they really were an employee. And let's just say it was for a full calendar year and they got paid, you know, the average amount, $65,000. Well, the company has to go back and repay those payroll taxes. And then they have to pay those payroll taxes with a penalty because they didn't pay them on time to begin with. They also have to pay a fine oftentimes, and that fine can vary greatly. So here's why it's really important to put an institutionalized process in place to manage your IC compliance. Whether you go through, you know, compliance solutions and shortlist, or whether you know go through some other provider, the really important thing is that you institutionalize this understanding that freelance workers need to be properly classified. If you intentionally or found to be intentionally avoiding the W-2 classification in order to save money, in order to avoid paying the payroll taxes, in order to avoid extending healthcare and other benefits to your employees or to your workers, they can identify that, and they can extend the look back period, which is what the IRS or DOL, Department of Labor, look at. When they go back and try to assess your penalty or your back taxes, payroll taxes you have to pay, if it was a true mistake and just a wrong call, but you've got good processes in place, they'll go back, you know, that 1 year or 2 years maybe. But if you're found to have intentionally avoided the proper classification, they can go back for up to 5 years, and that just is a huge multiple when you're talking about potentially, you know, somewhere between a $50,000-$80,000 for an average contractor. Now, so that's just if you're looking at one contractor. What we've seen, and a lot of the things that hit the news recently are the class action suits, where a full class of contractors is being reclassified. You know, those are the ones where you really want to protect yourself by having the right contracts in place, by having the right agent of record in place. And even though there's a lot of activity around arbitration agreements these days, you know, the going thinking is from a legal, and I'm not a lawyer, but you know, our counsel guides us, is have an arbitration agreement in place with your contractors. That way the companies are limiting their exposure and having another remedy in the event that there's an inquiry about an improper classification.
And that's great. And to get more into these best practices, and it sounds like having a proactive process in place is really important. In terms of, you know, training and education or communication, what else would you recommend to the average company to get ahead of some of these?
Yeah, I think the and we're never surprised to find even Fortune 500 companies who who are engaging hundreds and, you know, maybe over 1,000 freelancers, and they don't have formal classification screening processes in place. They don't leverage a program approach or use a third-party provider like ourselves to help them manage that. So one is just awareness, you know, recognize that you have a risk. And certainly if companies are engaging that many freelancers, they generally, their legal counsel, somebody in regulatory compliance has raised the flag and said, hey, we should probably think about this. So, but nonetheless, awareness is step number one. Step number two is getting that assessment that we talked about. The assessment that we do takes a close look at what your current state is. It matters if you have a solution in place to do the screening and to engage the contractors and to attempt to classify them properly. But it also matters if that solution isn't effective. And we need to help tease that out. A lot of companies will, when they first start using freelancers, they'll lean on, you know, oftentimes their staffing firms or some other vendor that they have available to them and say, hey, can you payroll this person? And then it becomes, hey, can you screen this person for IC classification? And that's fine for, you know, very small volumes and kind of do, you know, very infrequently. But it's actually not fine if you kind of take that kind of approach into in your freelance population grows significantly. Because when you're managing a large number of them, then, you know, the burden is on you, the company organization, to actually put proper procedures in place to operationalize it so that all freelancers are properly screened and classified. And then certainly with the growth comes the risk. So those are the things that I would recommend that companies kind of think about. And then once you get that assessment and kind of develop an awareness that, hey, yeah, we need some kind of help, then you can start looking at the different solutions that are available to you.
Yeah, and to get into some of these solutions, because they do seem sort of involved, especially as you know, a company might grow its external workforce and scale in that manner, some of these things might seem a bit high touch. So how would you scale a solution like that? I mean, what is some of that those solutions look like?
Yeah, so you know, when we talk about traditional solutions where we're taking each individual engagement and you know, there's a lack of technology or automation that is directly addressing the marketplace for the client company to engage that freelancer or that contractor, generally the compliance support falls in line or layers on top of whatever the operational engagement or acquisition model is for the talent of that company. So that's really what we recognize first. You can't go in as the compliance provider and say, hey, you know, you're engaging freelancers or you're acquiring these contractors in a really bad way, and you know, we can't provide you compliance support for that. Well, the truth is that's not true. I mean, we can, but what we like to see and what we're encouraging more and more so nowadays with the advent of the contract management systems, freelance management systems, the gig platforms, companies like Shortlist who are really creating a marketplace to make it efficient and effective and address all the marketplace connections between a contractor and a client. What we really like to do is infuse our services, our compliance screening, our agent of record services into that platform or that technology that the company's using. Because if we can do that, then we accomplish a few things. One, we're in line with what that company has already sort of decided is acceptable to them to engage contingent workers, to engage freelance workers. So that's job number one. If you go in and you say, well, I can't support that, and they don't have the, you know, the political will within the organization to change the underlying engagement or acquisition of their talent, then, you know, it doesn't make any sense to say you can't add compliance layer on top of that. But if you have a high volume organization and they've recognized the value inefficiencies of going to a platform to support engagement of freelancers, we think that's the best way to scale. And here's an example of why. If you have the compliance screening and the monitoring that we do infused into the platform so that neither the contractor nor the client manager has to go outside the platform to do some compliance related stuff, your adoption and your participation and your adherence to policy is much greater. So just the ease of use for that user is really important. Secondly, when you have a platform like that, you still have to make that determination between is it traditional or is it gig? And we started talking about that earlier. Let me add a little bit to sort of make this point. You can have a platform like Shortlist that could be either gig or traditional. It really matters on the underlying engagement that the client perceives with their talent, with their contractors. And what we look at are those parameters that help us say, okay, well, here's how you're using the platform. Here's how we can support it. Here's how we can help you maintain your almost immediate on-demand, real-time classification of your gig workers. I mean, we can do that. But the reality is most business models or talent acquisition models that are using contract management and freelance management solutions tend to fall into the traditional space, and here's why. So took a long time to get to this point, but here's why. The commonality of the work that you're sending to those, putting out there on the platform for the contractors to engage with, and the lack of a pre-vetted contractor population causes us to take the traditional approach to doing that screening. We have to do the interviews. We have to get the forms filled out. We have to, on both the contractor side as well as the client side. And that can be time consuming and laborious, and it's not exactly in sync with today's modern technologies that support the talent acquisition model. So what we're really excited about is this ability to take the Shortlist platform, because we've proved it. We've got some great cases already underway in our partnership with Shortlist, and we've done a lot of pre-vetting of the contractors and the engagements, if you will, that allow us to not do real-time classification, although there is a narrow path where we can do it. But if we have to pop it out in our queue, usually we can do it in a matter of one or two business days versus the traditional, non-platform based solution that takes, anywhere from 8 to 15 days. No kidding, 8 to 15 days, because you have to address each contractor and each engagement structure, work description individually. What we like about the platform, and I think the glue that kind of creates that ability, that foundation to do it, is there's a commonality. There's, I won't call it complete standardization, but there's a move towards standardization that we're able to leverage in our compliance screening and delivery of our compliance support services that we're able to take advantage of. And we couldn't do that if we weren't infused with the platform itself and working with you and the rest of the Shortlist team, so that when you're implementing your platform, we're also implementing our compliance solution, so that it's almost seamless to both the client and to the contractors when they're coming in. And that's our goal. It's a secondary goal, because our first goal is to make sure we're making proper classifications. But the secondary goal is to support the platform's business model of creating and supporting that efficient, fully transparent, well-oiled marketplace between buyers and sellers.
And that single source of information, I think, via the platform model with freelancer management systems or contractor management systems is important. And I can see how that pre-vetting would be challenging. You mentioned 8 to 15 days, and I would imagine, you know, a lot of that would be going back through email records and really non-scalable methods. So I can see how that platform model would help you do your job better in terms of spotting these misclassification risks, while also putting the, you know, the safeguards in place to protect, you know, you from these pitfalls.
Absolutely. And what we've got going on in the back end is we have developed and we're continually adding to, you know, our compliance rules engine. And what that allows us to do is to take the information that both from the contractor side as well as the client engagement side, take those inputs and run them up against our rules and get early, quick, easy decisions. So for instance, we would never give an automated classification decision for any IC coming out of California, right? So we're checking the states. That's an easy one to say that's a rule. We have to lay our eyes, our hands on that one and really take a second look just because of all the fluidity in their regulatory environment. But if it's in a state like Oklahoma or it's a we've already predetermined that the client engagement is very unique and it's truly structured as a project base, and it's not part of what the client organization does on in their normal course of business. If we've kind of been able to check all the boxes, then we can look at the profile of that contractor, as long as they're IC pre-check certified. You know, we've done the pre-vetting on them. Then when those two things get matched in the platform, then we can say either automate the classification because we've done all our homework for these two, for this very scenario, or we look at it and we say, you know what, this is close, but let's just lay our eyes on it just to get that second look at it, make sure that we got maybe an extra piece of documentation from the contractor, or maybe if there was a slight alteration or amendment to the work description that we had originally pre-vetted. Those are the kind of things that pop out in our queue and we make quick work of. And we can work it within, you know, usually a day, but we allow ourselves with our SLAs 2 days to do it. That near real-time classification, you know, is still far superior to, you know, the 8+ days.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. Michael, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Really enjoy our partnership and relationship with Shortlist. Thanks, Tyler.